And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Stay tuned, and we'll come right back with our guests. And this is Occupied Territory. We're here every Thursday, live, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And, of course, all the shows are available on podcast. We have our Facebook page, which we urge anybody who's a brand-new listener and any of you old listeners who want to go to. Just go to the Occupied Territory page on PRN.FM, the Occupied Territory page right on this station. And it will lead you straight to our Facebook page where we post all kinds of images, videos, opinions, articles, and responses. So join up. And today, my first guest, we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in New York State. And this may sound familiar to a lot of people from a long time ago, but nothing ever really changes. One hopes it does change permanently, but maybe that's not the way life is. I got a notice on my in my inbox the other day from the New York Civil Liberties Union about farm workers trying to organize upstate. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. We have with us Reverend Richard Witt. Hello.
Morning, or afternoon, I guess.
Afternoon, just barely afternoon. Let me introduce you to people, and then we'll discuss this situation. Richard Witt, Reverend Richard Witt, has served as Executive Director of Rural and Migrant Ministry since 1991. And he's also served in congregations in New York and Massachusetts and as a chaplain at Vassar College. He has degrees from Boston University and the Episcopal Divinity School, as well as a general course certificate from the London School of Economics. And he's a Trinity Transformational Fellow with Trinity Church on Wall Street. So we can start off by talking about what the Rural and Migrant Ministry is.
Well, Rural Migrant Ministry, also known as RMM, is a organization that is committed to empowerment in rural New York, and specifically to nurturing leaders in our rural areas, especially farm workers, that want to improve working and living conditions.
Now, the article I got from the press release from NY, New York Civil Liberties Union, is about passing Farm Workers Fair Labor Practices Act. Maybe you could explain what the situation is, why that arises, why one is needed, and what it is.
Okay, well, it actually goes back over 70 years when President Roosevelt was trying to establish regulations and laws that would protect workers and improve worker safety. And in order for him to get that passed, he needed the support of the Southern legislators, the Dixiecrats, and they responded saying, if we're going to give you our votes, you can't include farm workers or domestic workers because we can't have people of color being treated equally. And so he cut that deal, figuring that he'd come back and get farm workers and domestic workers included. New York at the same time adopted a similar set of protections as well as a similar set of exclusions. And needless to say, nobody ever went back to include the farm workers. The domestic workers just got some rights a year or so ago in New York. But the farm workers are still excluded. And what that means is that they're excluded from many of the basic rights afforded most of us under New York State labor law. For example, farm workers are excluded from the right to a day of rest. They're excluded from disability insurance, from overtime pay, and from protections while bargaining collectively, to name but a few of them.
So is this something that that also exists in other states, too, still, as well?
It does. Some states have some protections here and there, the most notable of which, of course, is California, which removed a number of these exclusions during the time of Cesar Chavez.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think anybody of an age remembers that was a national campaign and a national cause, which was one of the uplifting things, one of the few, I have to say at this point, uplifting things I've seen in terms of activism in American history during my lifetime, was that people all over the country seemed to understand that and participate in this boycott of grapes out there and grape products. And it helped the workers here. But, I mean, could you imagine a similar thing happening now?
Well, I think, actually, you know, people still generally understand the importance of this and the rightfulness of this. Mm-hmm. There have been a number of statewide polls that have been done in recent years, and the numbers supporting farm workers being treated equally is in, like, the 70s and 80% across the state.
Mm-hmm.
And again, across the state, people from faith communities, student communities, labor, are all joining in to demand that farm workers be treated equally.
Now, is there a farm workers union?
There is not a farm workers union in New York. There are some emerging farm worker-led organizations. You know, one of the things that's interesting about that exclusion of protection while bargaining collectively is that it's not just about unions. If two or three workers get together, and this happened a few years ago on an onion farm when 20-some workers were told that they were no longer going to have housing at the farm, and so they had to go find their own housing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine how hard it is to find housing when you're only here 4 or 5 months and you don't have first month, last month rent, and maybe you speak a different language.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these workers found housing about a half hour away, sort of living with other people, friends, relatives, what have you. They went back to their bosses and said, look, now that we have to pay for our own housing and our transportation, get back and forth, can we have a 50-cent an hour increase? And the boss said no. And then the boss said, and, you know, you're all fired, and since you all came to me as a collective, you don't have any protection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So do you think there's a chance that a law like this is going to get passed in the New York State legislature? Or are we dealing with a similar situation that we have all over the country in terms of large corporate organizations? In this case, it might be industrial farms or large farms interfering with this kind of thing, you know, lobbying politicians, that kind of thing.
Well, there are not the same size corporate
right.
farms
right.
In New York that maybe you find in California or Florida. The lead opposition to this bill in New York State is the New York State Farm Bureau, and they hold up frequently trying to protect small family farms. But there are a lot of family farms in New York State that don't have farm workers, and those that only have a couple of farm workers, we think, suffer unfairly from the farms that have many farm workers because it's an unfair economy of scale. As the large farms are being subsidized by the farm worker labor, the cheap cost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, the largest farm in New York State is actually a family farm, technically.
Right.
So one has to be careful with the naming, and that large farm has thousands of acres and several hundred workers.
Now, has it always been taken for granted, because I remember reading about this in novels and other situations going back decades now, that when people migrate up from the South or from other countries or something to do the picking, to do this hard labor, and one of the things that the New York Civil Liberties Union pointed out was that what if all these people decided to go on strike? I mean, it would be, you know, an endurance test for them that they could hardly survive, but what if they did do that? There wouldn't be any food, you know what I mean? It would just rot. It wouldn't get picked. So, but it's been always taken for granted, I think, that the farm workers who make so little and work so hard had some kind of rough housing provided by the farmers, right?
Many farms do provide housing, mm-hmm. and in many other situations, workers have to find their own housing. And, you know, going back for a second, one of the things that the Justice for Farm Workers campaign offered in trying to negotiate with the Farm Bureau a year or so ago was that the workers would agree to give notice before going on strike, and that there'd be a period before they could go on strike in order to protect the harvest.
Mm-hmm.
But keep in mind also that there are a lot of farm workers in New York that aren't working in harvesting. They're working on dairy farms. You know, New York is a major producer of milk.
Right.
And right now the dairy industry is doing rather well in New York, which is something else we often hear is now's not the right economic time.
Well, now is never the right economic time if you're a producer or an owner.
Right. No, well,
they have a different time zone than we do. So, but in this case, you know, when you're talking about, as you mentioned, that some of these farms are family farms, and I don't mean really large farms, but even middle or smaller family farms who might get affected by this. Times are tight for everyone. I'm not to be a devil's advocate, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, people will have to have less if they give other people more. That's the mathematics of the way people live with each other in a society, right?
Right, but our question is, what is the moral difference between a small family owner of a farm
mm-hmm.
and a small family owner of a drugstore or a dry cleaning store? Where workers have more protections and where those owners would love to, you know, save costs.
Mm-hmm.
What makes it different that we say that the farmers don't have to protect or treat equally their workers?
What is a farm worker? Do you have figures? What does a farm worker make on average in New York State?
I'm afraid I don't have those figures. So, part of the difficulty is that there's really nobody in New York State that can tell you exactly how many farm workers there are or what their situation is. We don't have the resources to do that kind of survey, and the government doesn't seem to be interested in that kind of survey. And Cornell University, the land-grant institution, hasn't mm-hmm. done that. People can tell you exactly how many cows there are on each farm,
mm-hmm.
but they can't tell you about the workers.
Well, we're talking about property when we talk about cows. I mean, I don't want to veer off into a description of capitalism, but property. You know what happened during the riots. I remember there was some mayor. I think it was the mayor of Newark or something in the 60s said the most important thing when he ordered the National Guard out into the streets was make sure you protect property. Anybody, you know, you have the right to shoot anybody. I remember that one. You can shoot anybody if they're taking property. You know, after that comes if they're harming anybody. But if you see anybody taking property, that's how it goes. But as far as the farm workers upstate, we are talking about migrants. Are we being euphemistic here? Are we talking about people who are illegal aliens?
Well, we're talking about a variety of different farm workers in New York State.
Yeah.
You have folks that are farm working year-round because they're on the poultry farms or the dairy farms. Or they're in the orchards pruning trees in the middle of the winter.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about migrant workers that come up here on a crew, led by a crew chief, labor contractor. You're talking about guest workers through the governmental H-2A program.
Oh, right.
Where people come because our government enters into a contract with another government, usually Jamaica or Mexico.
Mm.
Where workers can come and work on a particular farm for a particular amount of time, and they have visas to be here. You know, the difficulty with that situation is that if they end up working on a bad situation, they can't just get up and leave. They can't say, well, I'm going to go work on this other farm. They're
right.
stuck
mm-hmm.
Where they are. And then you have a number of workers that are undocumented workers.
Mm-hmm. And so there, as far as their power goes, basically, if they don't have the right to bargain collectively, I mean, this is the kind of thing that they're turning the clock backwards in some places. Obviously, the big news next week will be the recall election out in Wisconsin, where, you know, they're trying to actually destroy any workers' rights or collective bargaining, you know, starting with public employees and trying to spread it actually to to private employees of private organizations. But in this case, are there any personalities who are leading this fight out there? Often in a movement like this, you need sort of a charismatic type. You mentioned Chavez earlier. I mean, sometimes this is important in a movement, right?
Well, I think that, I mean, I'm not sure how blessed we are with charismatic types. But
well, you know what I mean, some leader.
A leader that has been working the longest and the hardest on this campaign is a woman named Librada Paz, which translated means liberty, peace.
Mm-hmm.
A woman originally from Mexico, and she has been tireless in her efforts for close to 15 years, speaking in Albany, testifying at hearings, marching across New York State, leading round-the-clock vigils, protesting. I mean, Librada has really been at the forefront of all of this.
The farm workers do have power, though. I mean, if they really did manage, I mean, it would be terribly hard because, you know, if they're living in poverty or near poverty or hardly making it at all, I mean, to strike means I don't know who would feed them or how they'd live. But things like that have happened before. But they do have the power if they did manage to collectively stop working. I mean, a strike would actually put a tremendous amount of pressure, or a proposed strike would put pressure on the farm producers. After all, even if it wasn't harvest time, you still got, you know, as you said, you know, maintenance on farms and year-round operations. I mean, people have to eat. So they do have a certain kind of power, right?
I think farm workers have a tremendous amount of power, and I think that's one of the things that frightens the Farm Bureau, is the idea of sharing that power. Now, in their power, farm worker leaders have said time and time again that they are interested and committed to strengthening New York's agriculture. It's not in their interest to see New York agriculture go down the tubes.
Mm-hmm.
They want it to succeed, but they want to have a voice at the table, not to be the only voice at the table, but they want to have a voice at the table around issues that are affecting their lives and their families' lives.
So really, so putting pressure on legislators in New York State and passing a law that would, guarantee fair practices, labor practices, is an essential thing, right?
Absolutely, because, you know, the most important thing, and we've heard this from time again, farm workers saying, why are we treated as second-class citizens? This is an issue of dignity for us. And I think that if farm workers see the passage of the Fair Labor Practices Act, then it's a message of, yes, you are an equal, you are important, you are valued. And having that sense of dignity and that affirmation is tremendously empowering.
Hmm. Do you mind I should ask you, of course, where is it that people who are interested in supporting this or talking to the legislators or sending emails or support to statements of support to, let's say, the governor's office, where would they go? Can you give me a website where people can go?
Sure. Ruralmigrantministry.org.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get there.
Okay, ruralmigrantministry.org. And are there any events coming up in the state for people who live in New York State, or anything that's happening that people can
participate? Well, we just had a big Albany Day last week, and now what we're urging supporters to do is to write or call the governor,
mm-hmm,
and ask the governor to give farm workers equality. The governor is really in the position. He's really the main person in the position to bring about this change.
If you just tuned in, you're just joined us. You're listening to the Reverend Richard Witt, and he's the executive director of Rural and Migrant Ministry since 1991. Do you mind if I ask you a question, which is not necessarily off topic? It's obviously connected to everything, but this show is devoted to the Occupy movement, or to the issues that the Occupy movement brought up.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your opinion about the Occupy movement and what's happening with it and where it'll go, that kind of thing?
I think that one of the most important aspects of the Occupy movement is people having their voice heard. You know, the people that have been taken for granted, the people that have been disenfranchised, that have been abused, having their voice heard, and having their voice at the table of public policy and private policy decision making.
Now, being somebody who's been involved in things for a long, long time, we're all aware of the fact that there is no representation at that table. That table is in some back room somewhere guarded by literally militarized police. I mean, that's why we theoretically have a representative government. But the reason that the Occupy, one of the reasons the Occupy movement is out there on the streets is because people have, it's dawned on people that there is no place at the table and their representatives aren't doing anything about it. But here you are, you're still working within a certain kind of system, right? You know, go talk to the governor, pressure the governor, pressure the legislators, and you have to do that. But generally speaking, do you think that's still an effective way for an average American to change things?
Well,
I know it's a big question, but still, that's the reason a lot of people are out there in the streets. They don't pay it. They finally woke up and saw that it doesn't make any difference, really.
We've always felt in the Justice for Farmworkers campaign that you have to work in a number of different realms. And mm-hmm. So we work within the system. And we've seen progress in that. I mean, when we first started 15 years ago, it was a big deal for us to meet to the aide to the janitor.
Mm-hmm.
And now, in recent years, farm workers have met directly with the governor and have met with the Senate majority leaders, what have you. So, the voice of the farm worker is being heard. Whether it's being honored, you know, is still up for debate. But it's being heard when it wasn't being heard before. At the same time, we work outside of the system. A couple of years ago, a couple of people decided to start shooting at farm workers working in the field. And the local sheriff didn't want to bring charges against those folk. And we had, a mini Occupy of the sheriff's office, forcing him to bring charges. So we've believed that you have to work in a variety of different directions.
Yeah, I guess when it breaks out into certain other areas, you have to respond as much as you can within the structure of the law to those other areas. I mean, certainly if something like you mentioned has to be dealt with in a direct pressurized way. You can't go through some kind of voting process with that. So,
right.
All right, listen. So once again, the website is what?
RuralMigrantMinistry.org.
Okay, RuralMigrantMinistry.org. And no time like the present, like they always say. I mean, there's a lot going on. And I get constant talking about being heard. I never stop being told by Governor Cuomo every day on my inbox what he's been doing. So obviously, if he can speak that much, maybe he can also, maybe the channel is open in the other direction. So if you wanted to pressure the governor here or to suggest to the governor he do the right thing for the farm workers, that's easy enough to do. You can also go to I guess it's newyorkstate.gov or whatever the New York State website is, and mm-hmm. you'll find a way to get in touch with the governor's office. He does appear, actually, to negotiate and to dialogue, to use a certain word, with people. So that's useful, at least in our case. Thank you very much for coming on.
All right. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Reverend
Bye-bye.
Richard Witt, and that's Rural and Migrant Ministry. All right. This is Mike Fader on Occupied Territory. Once again, remember our Facebook page. A lot of stuff going on there. The podcasts of other of the old shows, recent shows. And lots of videos. We post articles that we think are important out there. People dialogue back and forth, and you can join. When you go there, like it or join it, and also you can comment on it. Send any photos you have of anything that's going on, too, any protests, any place you've been, any parades, demonstrations, marches. This is the time when it's going on. The conventions are coming up in the summer, which is going to, speaking of making your voice heard, the conventions are going to be extremely militarized. They're going to try to keep people quiet and far away from the political process, as if we aren't far away from it at all. So we're going to build up to that as the summer goes on. In Charlotte and Tampa is where the action's going to be. But anything else that's going on, go to that Facebook page. You can do that by, you know, you're on prn.fm. Go to the Occupied Territory page on there, the Occupied Territory show page, and then there's a way to get onto the Facebook page from there. We're going to take a little break here, and then we'll be back with another guest. Okay, we're back. This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. I want to mention I have another show here on PRN.FM. It's on Mondays at 4 p.m., Mondays at 4 p.m. called The Turning Point. Switching gears here, and of course we're never really switching gears because it's all about the same thing, which is inequality and trying to assert our right to freedom of speech to equalize things. A lot of people in this country, we've got our own problems, right? But what's going up in Canada, often Americans don't pay attention to. But now there's something that we all should be paying attention to because there are massive demonstrations going on up in Canada. Basically, they started out in Quebec and for particular reasons. And the government up in Canada, the federal government or their version of the federal government, is passing laws which are as bad or worse than ours in terms of directly and bluntly suppressing freedom of speech. And let me read you something that was from just a ways back here, not too long ago. And there was an article in the World Summary in the New York Times. Nearly 700 people were arrested on Wednesday night after a protest over sharply higher university tuition in Quebec erupted into another night of violence. 700 people. The student protests have only grown since the provincial government passed emergency legislation last week to shut some schools temporarily in an attempt to end Canada's most sustained student demonstrations. The protest on Wednesday, this is back, you know, was declared illegal. The protest is declared illegal, get that, by the police because demonstrators did not provide an itinerary as required by the controversial new law, which we're going to talk about here with our guest, which says the police must be informed 8 hours before a protest and told the route of any demonstration that includes 50 or more people. And also that you have to dress up in nice little tuxedos and dresses, and you have to be very polite, never raise your voice, and raise your hand if you want to say something. Unbelievable. Quebec neighborhoods, let's see, the protest began with an almost party-like atmosphere, I'm quoting the New York Times now, in many Quebec neighborhoods, but turned serious after protesters, it says here, began throwing objects at police officers in Montreal. The police said 518 people were arrested in Montreal and 176 in Quebec City. The protesters are demanding that the Quebec's premier, Jean Charest, roll back tuition increases of about $250 per year, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So these student protests start up, and then we have a bill that's been passed to suppress dissent. And that sounds terribly familiar to all of us, I think. And we have with us Ethan Cox today. Hi, Ethan.
How you doing?
Now, Ethan is there's a website called, is it called Rabble?
Yeah, rabble.ca.
Rabble.ca. And now, Ethan Cox is Rabble's special correspondent on the Quebec student strike. Ethan Cox, he's a 28-year-old organizer and writer from Montreal. Says here he cut his political teeth accrediting the Dawson Student Union against opposition from college from the college administration. Dawson Student Union, what was that?
Well, it's a long story, but in a nutshell, we have a CJEP system here in Quebec, which is basically the equivalent of what would be grade 12 and 13, mm-hmm. and it's a primarily pre-university two-year college system. Mm-hmm. And when I was there, our student union was collecting $285,000 a year in student union dues, of which the student union only had control over about $85,000. So we sought to accredit the student union in order to have complete control over our money and end this theft by the administration. And luckily enough, in Quebec, we have a law that allows student unions to gain legal recognition in a similar way to a labor union being recognized. The administration were obviously not thrilled at the prospect of losing this money that they were stealing from us, and refused to recognize the existing student union executive, the incoming student union executive, and appointed four students no one had ever elected to sign a deal transferring all the money back to the administration. So we were forced to go to court with them, and did succeed in winning and taking control of our student union after about a year-long legal battle.
Well, that's good work. That's good work. And people, you know, are people trying to do that kind of thing down here? Maybe with less success. Also, Ethan Cox has worked as a union organizer for the Public Service Alliance of Canada, also worked on several successful municipal and federal election campaigns in Canada, was a member of Quebec's central office staff for the NDP. What is the NDP?
It's the New Democratic Party. It's the most left-wing and progressive party in Canada.
Okay.
Historically, it's always been a third party, and basically its best moments have been to form a coalition government with the sort of center-left Liberal Party, which was what created things like Medicare in the past that we have here. However, in the last election in 2011, there was a historic realignment, and the left-wing progressive social democratic socialist NDP are now the official opposition and poised to hopefully take government in the next election in 2015.
2015, long way off.
Yeah, the next federal one, yeah.
So how did all this start? What is going on up there, and how did it start?
Sure. Well, basically, it's important, first of all, for listeners in the U.S. to understand that there is a fairly significant distinction between Quebec and the rest of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Quebec is obviously the Francophone province, and here in this province, we have a long and proud history of protest, of resistance. Historically, Francophones in Quebec were oppressed and treated as second-class citizens by Anglophones, which led to the Quiet Revolution in the 1960s, which was a taking back of control of their own society by Francophones. And so there's a long and proud tradition that isn't quite as prevalent in the U.S. or in the rest of Canada of being able to seize control of what's going on. And so in the history of this province, you often hear the statistic cited that Quebec has the lowest tuition fees in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why we do is because every time anybody tries to raise our tuition fees, we have long and protracted general strikes of students. And in the past, in almost every occasion, have been successful in forcing the government to back down from attempts to raise tuition or cut loans and bursaries.
Well, let me interrupt you for one second here. When you talk about tuition, these are public universities?
Yeah.
Okay.
All of our universities are public.
So, well, what is a tuition, for instance, at this moment for a public university?
Sure. Well, it's slightly under $3,000 a year in Quebec.
Mm-hmm. And so they want to raise it.
So it is quite low.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, and they want to raise it by about 75% to just under 4,000.
Mm-hmm.
So 4,500.
Now, what if I'm sure that this is what they say, but what if, let's say, I'm acting the role of a representative of the government in Quebec or somebody who's in charge of the budget, and I say, we have to raise it because we just can't afford it anymore not to raise it. We'll have to lay off teachers. We'll have to close laboratories. You people don't understand what things cost. Why are you making so much trouble?
Well, this is the crux of the matter, and that is certainly the argument that's being deployed against us. But the reality is, I'm sure people there are just as well aware of, is that what this struggle is about, so much more than tuition, is about a rejection of the current economic model, which is broken. And that model is the one whereby we give billions of dollars of tax cuts to profitable corporations, high-income earners, and then turn around and say, look, we're broke, we have to slash social programs. It is not a question of not having the money to pay for education. It's a question question of where our priorities are. And in the last number of years, the Quebec government under Jean Charest has spent billions upon billions of dollars cutting the taxes of profitable corporations with no return, no significant job creation, no significant stimulus to the economy.
I was just going to say that the excuse they give down here all the time, which is at this point utter nonsense, and everybody with a brain knows it, is that these are the job creators, quote unquote, or that it'll trickle down. It doesn't trickle down up in Canada any more than it trickles down here, I'm sure. And is he the governor? What's his title?
The premier.
The premier of Quebec, right? Okay,
yeah.
So is he what we would call a right winger down here, a conservative?
Yeah, he's very right wing. He's actually a former federal conservative, which is our most right wing party. Not quite as crazy as the Republicans, but they occupy that territory on the spectrum, and so it's an extremely right wing austerity, government. However, as I was getting at with this history that we have. It's been very difficult for him. His goal is to implement austerity / social programs, all of the things we're seeing across the continent. But there's a huge amount of resistance in society in Quebec because we're very fond of our social programs and very fond of the way that our society functions. And so he's been sort of trying to do it piecemeal. And this issue with tuition, the 75% increase, is the first major conflict. And so what happened was there's been opposition to the tuition hikes, which were announced last year, that's been building on campuses. And in February, a general strike was called of student unions. And I know this is probably a bit of an alien concept in the States, but here we have accredited student unions. So almost all of the post-secondary institutions in Quebec are legally accredited. They have legal protection and recognition and legally elected executives. And what they can do is they can call a general assembly of their members and invite all of the students at a school to a general assembly. And if the students there then vote to go on strike, then the school will be blocked off by picket lines and nobody will go to class.
Well, that's something we definitely don't have down here. I mean, there have been attempts to do that because there are the same kind of ridiculous, inexcusable tuition raises going on in public colleges down here, too, especially in New York City where I live. And people have taken to the streets, but there's no organization like that.
Yeah, and it's something that's really important when we've talked about exporting the lessons of the general strike here to other places. One of the first ones is, we have to build the strength of our associations. Because what's critical here is, in so many parts, at least in the rest of Canada, and I imagine in a lot of the states, it's the same. A student union is something the vast majority of students are unfamiliar with, or if they are, they think it's something that organizes parties for them.
I think that's what people think down here, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And here in Quebec, we have a completely different vision of what a student union is. We see it as our government, our political representation, our collective voice. And so if the student union says this is a problem, we need to do something about it, students respond and follow in the way that union members do their union leadership, which is not something that I think we have in English Canada or in the States.
So what happened was the students petitioned or talked about their grievances maybe and then finally decided to what, go on strike?
Yeah, it's always a last resort. But so in February, there are 400,000 university students in Quebec. About 150,000 are to this day on unlimited general strike, which means they've been on a indefined length strike, and about another 100 to 150,000 went on strikes of varying lengths for several weeks or even in some cases days. So you've got a significant chunk of the student body that have been on strike since February and have been in the street very actively since February. We're now, last night was the 37th consecutive daily demonstration. And so for the last 37 days to ratchet up the pressure, students have taken to the streets of Montreal and in fact cities across Quebec every single night in demonstration. And
what has been the response since the beginning?
Well, originally, I think public opinion was more in favor of the government's position than the students, and that's largely because, as you're talking about this propaganda of, oh, there's no money, so we have to do it, and everybody has to suffer, that has a significant impact. And the mainstream media have been, of course, completely against the students from day one.
Is that the same thing? So it's the same thing up there as it is down here, that the corporate media immediately sides with the wrong side.
Yeah, it's not as bad here. We're getting there, but we're not quite as badly off. But it's the similar problems. And so what really made a difference was that in the face of these unending student protests, these daily demonstrations and significant disruptions, Charest brought in this Law 78. And this is a law, as you were mentioning and referencing earlier, that restricts the ability to demonstrate.
So it's called Law 78, and this was proposed by the government and passed, right?
And
all right. And was it passed with a resounding majority? Is it a right wing government entirely?
Yeah, I mean the Liberal Party, which is liberal in name only, of Jean Charest, are the ones who have a majority government right now. So several of the opposition parties were strongly opposed to it, but it didn't wasn't able to prevent it from passing.
And the bill says what?
Well, it says a number of things. It says that in order to have a demonstration, you have to submit the location, the route, and all of this other information to the police 8 hours in advance, and that the police have the right to refuse your right to have a demonstration if they think it's a problem or something. In addition, it also it ended the school semester for the striking students to be resumed in August. It also gives the Minister of Education the extraordinary power to create regulations that have the force of law, and to create regulations which violate existing law at her sole discretion, which is kind of a crazy blank check to give to a minister. It also has a reverse onus provision in it. It has huge fines for student associations, federations, and even individuals who in any way break the law, in any way try and prevent people from going to class. It's a traditional strike-breaking law, right? Anything that you do to try and maintain the strike, you're going to be heavily fined, heavily punished for. Its language is so broad that it could be interpreted that going on Twitter or Facebook and promoting a demonstration which is quote-unquote illegal, keeping in mind that all of our demonstrations are now illegal, would be something that you could be fined $25,000 for. So it's a real crackdown on the freedom of speech and the freedom of assembly of people here. And perhaps even worse, what it does is it says that, remembering that this it has this reverse onus provision that says that rather than how our legal system has worked for thousands of years, student unions and federations are responsible for proving that if one of their supporters broke the law, they were not acting on behalf of the student federation. And if they can't prove that, then the government can actually cut off the ability of our student unions to collect dues from their members at a rate of 1 year for every day that they're judged to be violating this law.
Oh, that's amazing. So you said, they are turning things upside down. Instead of, there's no innocent till proven guilty. You're guilty until you prove you're innocent.
Yes, exactly, which is crazy, right? It's completely contrary to our legal standard. And that last thing I was explaining allows the government to eliminate student unions or any representation for students at certain schools for a decade or longer. So it's basically a situation where Charest finds the students really annoying, we're a thorn in his side, the student associations are always causing him problems. So, hey, look, he found this beautiful way with this law that he can simply dispatch his enemies permanently. But that's not how we do things in a democracy.
What is the reaction of the larger government, of the Harper government?
Well, they've stayed largely out of it.
So it's almost like our federal government and states' rights or something, right?
It is, because in Quebec, you're probably familiar, we've had a couple of referendums on separating from the country.
Right, sure.
It's a very distinct society, and people in Quebec take very, very poorly to the federal government intervening in what is considered to be provincial jurisdiction. So every federal politician from the left-wing party, from the right-wing party, have kind of stayed hands-off.
Well, that's
these secondary issues.
That's bad and it's good, right?
Yeah, it depends. It depends when. But so the interesting thing with Bill 78 is just that it's been, when it was introduced, it was such a spectacular backfire, because in this province, like I was saying, we have this tradition of protest, we have this tradition, and when Quebecers saw that their fundamental rights to protest, to freedom of assembly, to freedom of speech were under threat, the public opinion swung massively in a period of 6 to 10 days. To being now very strongly in support of the students' cause and very much opposed to Bill 78. The last poll had about 60% of Quebecers being opposed to it. And on May 22nd, shortly after this law was passed, we had the largest demonstration in the history of Canada. We had around 400,000 to 500,000 people in the streets of Montreal at an illegal demonstration.
How many people? How many people?
400,000 to 500,000. So what's, almost 500,000 people actively breaking the law.
This is what is the population of Montreal roughly?
Well, there's a bunch of different definitions of Montreal.
Oh, okay.
the city of Montreal's population is about 3 million, and there are a lot of outlying suburbs.
But 500,000 people is, I mean, if you adjusted for inflation, to use a certain phrase, back down in here, if that was in New York City or in Washington, that would be a couple of million people on the street, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is what they call the night of the casseroles. Maybe you could explain that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a slightly different thing. Also, at the same time, so that one protest was our, you know, big everybody in the street to support the students and oppose this law.
That's impressive.
And then around the same time, after this law was passed, people started protesting against the law by having what we've called casserole. And these are modeled on something called cacerolazza in Chile, which was a form of protest against the Pinochet dictatorship, where people would go outside on their balconies in front of their streets and bang pots and wooden spoons to make a big cacophonous racket. And so since this law was passed, every night, more and more Quebecers have been taking to the streets and marching with pots and pans, banging them in these casseroles. And what's really incredible about them is that they're very community-based. So there are, instead of having one big protest march, there are hundreds of protest marches in every community, in communities that have never seen a protest before, where groups as small as 10 and as big as 10,000 are marching and banging their pots and pans in opposition to this law and in acts of civil disobedience, because these demonstrations are, of course, illegal as well. And it's really had an incredible impact. And what I was involved in organizing yesterday was we actually organized a casserole night in Canada, where we had people from one end of the country to the other, having these casserole protests in support and solidarity with the Quebec student movement. And in fact, there were also solidarity protests that took place in New York, in Washington, in Little Rock, Arkansas, in Madison, Wisconsin, in a number of other locations in the U.S., as well as in London, in Paris, in Brussels last night. There were about 5,000 people marching in the streets of Brussels and Belgium last night in support of the Quebec student movement.
Maybe this is a good time before we move on a little bit to we got a few more minutes. It's a good time to ask you exactly where people can go to see images of this and to help out and to learn more about it. Where exactly do they go?
Well, we're working on creating a website for the International Solidarity Casserole effort. Mm-hmm. But right now, if you go on Facebook, there was an event for last night called Wednesday, May 30th, Casserole Night in Canada. And also on Twitter, you can go to the hashtag Casserole Night in Canada. And I should spell casserole. It's CASSEROLES. And then Night in Canada, okay, or CNIC. And those are both the hashtags that are being used on Twitter.
Okay. What about Rabble? What's that? Can people go there for information?
Yeah, absolutely. Rabble.ca is a great place to go. It's independent media. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the largest left-wing progressive independent news sites in Canada. And so there's a whole whack load of articles there. We actually have a dedicated page there that has the live feed, because there's a local community television station that's been live streaming from all of the protests that has an interactive map of all of the different casseroles. So going to rabble.ca is a great place to go to check out what's happening.
One last question, because we only have a couple of minutes left, and you're listening here to Ethan Cox, who does a lot of writing and activism up in Canada right now about the Quebec student movement and this thing called Bill 78, which is suppression of freedom of speech and assembly that we all understand down here. The Occupy, and we only have a couple of minutes here, but let me ask you this. The Occupy movement down here started out with a lot of encampments, which were very dramatic and had a profound effect, at least even a visual effect, on what was going on in this country, pointing out income inequality. The encampments have practically disappeared for the same reason. The governments have responded with unconstitutional laws and militarized police and everything else. But they have injected this whole idea of income inequality and suppression of freedom of speech into the national dialogue. And I wanted to ask you this. There's been a lot of arguing going on down here, and we're getting to the point of almost explosiveness as far as the Occupy movement and various people who are very prominent, who write about it or who are in it, about violence and nonviolence. And the New York Times, which is always on the wrong side of this issue, has reported, according to them, that there was violence up in Montreal when all those people got arrested. What has been the level of violence in terms of the occupiers or the protesters up there and the response of the police?
Well, I think the reality is that there hasn't been a mass protest movement in history where there weren't a couple of people that decided they were going to go smash some windows, you know? Mm-hmm. When our hockey team wins the Stanley Cup, we have much bigger riots and break much more stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there have been some windows broken, there was a fire set. But a good example is you were quoting that New York Times article earlier and talking about how these mass arrests of 700 people were provoked by things being thrown at the police.
That's right.
And that's a really, really good example of how there is some violence, but it's really overblown, because that night in particular, the police justified those mass arrests saying that there were about a bunch of rocks being thrown at them and an incendiary device thrown at them. But journalists from the mainstream media who were on the ground at the front of the march, about four or five of them immediately tweeted that that wasn't true. Mm-hmm. And they immediately tweeted that the only thing that had been thrown at the police was one water bottle, and that was the sole provocation for this. So it was sort of a clear example where the police were lying. But the terrible thing was, in the mainstream media the next day, they went with the report from the police without mentioning that their own journalists had contradicted it.
Well, the same exact thing has happened down here, and I'm sure you're familiar with that. The people who were covering from the New York Times and other New York newspapers were covering what was going on in Zuccotti Park when the police were beating on people and spraying people. When the media attempted to cover it, they themselves got shoved against walls, they got arrested, they got knocked down, and the papers did not even report that. They just reported that the crowd was violent. So we've got the same problem down here.
Yeah, it's an easy out, right? And wherever there is any amount of violence, the media will be naturally drawn to it because it makes for good visuals and it looks good on television, and it also undermines the movement, right? So it's very similar issues that we're facing here. And in particular, the independent media have been targeted. So we have CUTV, which is actually a university television station that has been live streaming from all of the protests. Mm-hmm. And it's really revolutionized social movements for us here, because by having this live stream available on the internet, everybody everywhere in the province can turn it on and watch an unfiltered feed of what's happening at the protest, judge for themselves how the police are behaving, how the protesters are behaving. And it's really allowed people who aren't able to go to the protest or who live in the middle of nowhere to really tap into it, and it's helped a lot to spread this thing, and it's very good for the protest. So as a result, this television station's camera has been attacked by the police repeatedly. One of their camera people has two broken ribs, another one suffered a concussion, all from being beaten. Their camera has been broken on numerous occasions because the police have specifically targeted them and attacked them with batons and tried to damage the camera, tried to hurt the staff.
But the major media up there doesn't report even that, right?
No. I mean, there's some mention of it, and it depends on the journalist. And, you know, it's not quite as bad. There is some mention when the cops go too far, but it's a problem, and it's the same problem that you guys have up there, of course, or down there.
Well, all right. Last question is, we only got a couple of, like, 2 minutes left. Last question is this. There's a lot of debate down here right now about whether nonviolence, I don't know about Canada so much, but I know the United States. The United States is a violent country. It was always a violent country. It's been a violent country since the day it was born, or at least since white people decided to give it birth, you know, Europeans. I don't know what the feeling is like, or what Canadians are like, generally speaking, but this is a very violent country. It's the most violent country in the world right now. People are questioning whether or not nonviolence will ever work in this country. What's your opinion about something like that?
I had a professor many years ago who gave me an excellent perspective on this question, and I asked him about, you know, violence and protests, and he said, look, I'm not a pacifist. I'm all for the revolution, but you don't pick up arms, you don't take up violence until you're at a point where you can use it to win. So long as the state can beat you at violence, you don't play their game, right? And the problem with violence is we can't win. We can't beat the police services of violence. They're going to out-violence us every time. And if we resort to violence, we give them the excuse to unleash their own violence on us. So I think that it's really important that the only way we can win these things is through public opinion. And as messed up as the media is, we have to do the work required to win people over. And when we break windows, when we do these things, I don't think it brings any benefit to the movement. And I think it gives the media the excuse that they need to demonize us. And it gives the public at large the excuse that they need to write us off.
All right.
And
well,
I think it's really important not to give them that excuse.
All right. I think that's well put. And I think most people down here feel that way, although the frustration, is growing all the time. I guess that's really about all the time we have left here. Ethan Cox, and you can check his writing out on various subjects if you go to rabble.ca, rabble.ca. thanks for coming on down here, and you know, we'll take more reports from you if you don't mind from time to time.
Absolutely. I just wanted to add one thing.
Yeah, real quick.
This international solidarity movement that we started, we're going to continue it every Wednesday night, Casserole Night in Canada. We would love people in New York to keep having protests every Wednesday night. We're going to try and have protests in as many places as possible in support of this movement every Wednesday night going forward. Check out Casserole Night in Canada on Twitter, or go to Ravel.ca for more information.
Okay. Thank you, Ethan. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Okay, this is Occupied Territory. This is Mike Fader, and we'll be back next week with some more guests and some more issues. Meanwhile, check out our Facebook page. Just go to the Occupied Territory page on PRN.fm, and check out our whole other schedule here, too. This is the radical radio station in the country right now. Thanks for listening.